Thank you, Rich. Our next speaker is John Merrifield, who is a research fellow at the Independent Institute. He's professor of economics at the University of Texas at San Antonio. He received his PhD in economics from the University of Wyoming and has been a planning analyst at the Illinois Bureau of the Budget and has taught at the University of Illinois and the University of Hawaii. He's the author of The School Choice Wars, as I mentioned, and also a forthcoming monograph from the Institute called School Choices, True and False. His articles and reviews have appeared in many scholarly journals, including Public Choice, Public Studies, Policy Studies Review, Journal of Labor Research, Journal of Business Strategies, and many others. I'm delighted to introduce Professor John Merrifield. Well, I can't remember who told me that Richard would be a tough act to follow, but I now see why I was told. I'm normally after another speaker, the audience is getting restless because there's no problem with that here. What I'm going to address, since we pretty much addressed the reasons for the problems already, is why aren't we doing something about it? What's the problem with the school choice debate? Why aren't we winning the debate? I guess the short answer to that is we've dumbed it down. We've forgotten that what Milton Friedman first said back in the 50s and then again in his famous book in the 60s, we need competition. And we need competition bad enough that we have to give choice to everybody. We've got to turn the money over to the parents. Not any additional money, just the existing money. And if we do that, we get the competition. And that's the first part of my talk today, which is about the school choice fallacies. We seem to think, or so you would think if you listen to the debate, that if you give any choice to anybody, suddenly you have competition. Far from it. There are basic ingredients in a competitive system that limited tax credits, vouchers for poor kids, vouchers for low-performing school students, all the charter schools, all the things that you hear an awful lot about, that competition does not exist in any limited, in any way, shape, or form in these places. Limited rivalry is what I call it. Competition requires some contestability of market share. It requires flexible prices. In other words, people have to be able to decide what to charge for their services. The issue of price flexibility is perhaps the most neglected issue of all. Places like Milwaukee, Florida, they say that the schools, if they take a voucher, which by the way only goes to a limited number of poor kids, if they accept a voucher, it has to be for the full amount of the tuition. The schools are not allowed to charge more than that. It's probably the reason why Milwaukee is kind of stuck at about 10%, even though the vouchers are there enough for 15% of the kids, is the schools have to be able to outcompete. The private schools have to be able to outcompete public schools that have twice as much money. Right, so the kids are in effect told, if you can't make it in the public school, we'll give them a try, but you can only have half as much money. They have to be able to do better on about half as much money. It's pretty tough. I mean, it's better than the current system, which exists in most places, where if a private school wants to succeed, they have to be able to do better against somebody that's not charging anything at all. They have to compete against somebody giving away something, which is both a testament to the miracle that there are even private schools and a testament to how bad the system must be that people will forsake something that they've spent thousands of dollars a year for that's free, no additional charge, to go and either homeschool, which is an enormous time cost, that individual non-specialized parents can outcompete education specialists on their own at home with a computer, and that they would forsake this thing that they've spent a lot of money on already. So we need price flexibility. We need for businesses to be able to form schools and not have to compete against somebody who's giving away their product. That's when we'll have competition. There's some other less important ingredients you can read about in my book. But those are the main ones. We have to have contestability, ability to enter the market on a fairly level playing field, and the ability of the producers to charge tuition. Maybe not any more than the voucher, but they need to be free to charge more than that if they want to. By the way, one other point that I want to make about why the schools are failing now, we need choice, not just to generate competition, but we need choice in order to deal with the fact that we're different. We need schools not to have a one-size-fits-all mentality. The idea of assigning everybody that lives in the same geographic area to the same school is a recipe for failure. And it's no surprise when we treat everybody that's like they're the same, and they're not, that we utterly fail to educate them. We need to give them a chance, the teachers and the students alike, to sort themselves out according to their differing interests in things, and sometimes their different abilities to handle different subjects. I'm not talking about tracking. I'm talking about the fact that some kids are better in math than others and slower, the same kids slower in reading than others. We need to group them according to those different abilities. We also need to be able to group them according to different types of ways to teach kids. Some kids handle high-tech learning methods better than others. Some kids don't handle that well at all. We're not going to succeed ever if we have a one-size-fits-all mentality. I know that comes from the common school myth that we're supposed to teach everybody the same thing in approximately the same way, and I suppose that worked reasonably well when you had a one-room schoolhouse. But with our society as diverse as it is, and all the different technologies available to deal with these differences, it's a recipe for failure. Well, let me get into some of the other fallacies. Again, the first one was that any amount of choice yields competition. That's a huge fallacy, and that's why I object not to the Milwaukee voucher program per se, but to the idea that it's an experiment, and the idea that what's going on in Milwaukee will tell us if vouchers or choice is an answer to our fundamental problem. It's not. All it is a rescue program. If we recognize that, I'm all for the Milwaukee program. Let's rescue as many kids as we can. But it's not an experiment. It doesn't tell us whether choice can reform a school system. It's too small, and it doesn't allow price flexibility. It only allows a few kids to have choice, and they have to be poor. We need for everybody to be able to have a choice. If we do that somewhere, then we can call that an experiment. But let's just not call it an experiment. Therein lies my objection to it. Okay, one of the big fallacies is that we have this idea that only a few schools are bad. We think, oh, if we just move to the suburbs, everything will be fine. It's only bad in the inner city. Sadly, this is not true. This is one of the reasons that we have trouble passing voucher programs such as Prop 38 and Prop 174, both of which I have mixed feelings about, simply because the private school kids would only have gotten half as much money, the same problem I alluded to earlier. But it's one of the reasons that we have trouble passing those kinds of things, because people are widely under the illusion that it's only everybody else's school that's broken. That give me some school reform that leaves my school alone that fixes everybody else's school. Well, that's pretty tough to do when the problem that we have is that a need for a transformation of the school system. If you're going to transform the school system, and by that I don't mean to totally privatize it, which would be all right for me, but I mean transform it in the sense of incentives and accountability and not one size fits all. If we're going to do that, then we need to recognize that virtually all the schools are bad. Some are better than others. There's no question about that. You know, we rank them. We say, well, my kid goes to the best ranked school in town. Well, good. You have the best item on the menu. But have you ever been to a restaurant where the best item on the menu was still pretty bad? Well, that may be the case. Your kid may be in the best school in the area, but it still may be not a very good school given what should be accomplished with kids of a certain age. It may not be doing it. One of the reasons, go back to, it's not specialized. Therefore, inherently, it will underperform. We're all specialists in something. That's why we're so productive as a society. If schools would specialize, that alone would much increase their productivity. Another similar fallacy is that only low-income kids need help. Again, similar to the one that only a few schools are bad. No, the system is distorted for all. People have this false sense of security that if only they get out of the inner city or they move to a private school, things will be better. The way that we run the system, it's free if you go to a government-run school, but you got to pay twice otherwise, changes the whole system. It makes it bad for everybody other than, I suppose, the super rich that can send their kids to the $7,000 or $8,000 or more per year prep school. But most private schools are $2,000 or $3,000. Those offerings are diminished by the fact that they're competing against somebody free. That is free, at least as the economists say, free at the margin. They're not free, you know, that's paying your school taxes. But they're free in the sense that you don't have to pay anything extra to send their kids there, and you don't get any money back if you don't. You're not going to get a refund on your school taxes for homeschooling or for sending them to a private school. Let me go back to the few schools are bad notion again. I was reading as I was starting to work on my book about some questions that are answered by, I think it was 11th graders. And it was a simple, well, I regard it as a simple math question. How much do you owe on a loan after a year? And, you know, you're given the interest rate and the principal. 94% of the kids couldn't answer. And how many good schools can there be if you can't say on a $1,000 loan at 10% interest that you owe $1,100 at the end of a year? So, okay, again, you may be going to the best school in town, and maybe the second or third best, but it still may not be very good unless all the kids in that school are in that 6%. I kind of doubt it. So we need to face that piece of music. We're never going to change the system. We're never going to change it as long as people figure, kind of like late will be gone, that all our kids are above average. All of them are wonderful. Our schools are great. Only the rest of the country suffers from this decay that we keep reading about in these terrible disasters, some of which you've probably seen Jay Leno's jaywalking. I don't know how much he edits that. I hope an awful lot. For those, you know, where he answers simple questions and college students don't know the, again, I don't know how much he edits that. I hope an awful lot. If it's not, it may be too late. It may be too late to win an election of any kind on this issue. People may not understand the most basic economic arguments. I hope not. Another fallacy. It's widely thought that if we give vouchers that pay the full cost of private tuition, that's good enough. That full tuition vouchers, that eliminates the financial penalties, then we have competition. Now, as I alluded to earlier, if you give vouchers out that cover these really cheap private schools, they're still really cheap private schools. And the fact that they're more efficient is all the more reason to give them at least equal money, if not more. Now, that was the flaw in Prop 174 and Prop 38, is that we were going to make the more efficient operations have to prove themselves on half the money. Hey, if they're more efficient, let's give them twice the money, not half the money, right? In what system do we give the least efficient operators twice as much money as the more efficient ones? No others that I know of. Now, I know why that was in there. It's to try to appease some members of the system. That's always a failure. As Winston Churchill said, the appeaser is the one who hopes the crocodile will eat him last. I think that's right. I think that there's no point in appeasing teacher unions or some of these other groups. Again, I want to take sharp issue, draw a sharp distinction between the teachers union and the teachers. Chapter 14 of my book is about how we can win over the teachers. There's no hope of winning over the teacher unions. I mean, they have every reason in the world to fight to the death. I mean, we're talking about the officials in the unions against school choice, because it's the end of them if this happens. But the teachers have every reason, unless they're active in the union, to be all for school choice, because it will allow them to specialize and to compete for higher salaries and to do a whole bunch of other things that most of us think have something to do with being a professional. Things that I can do as a professor at a college, pick my textbooks, have something to say about curriculum, and so on, that current teachers don't have much say in. Another biggie, I call it the static world fallacy. Choice will occur from the existing school menu. I see this countless times in reading, and the thought is, well, if we have a voucher system, that won't do any good. There's only a couple thousand spaces in private schools. Well, that may be a relevant argument against a minimal voucher system for only a few kids or a little tiny voucher, but that's no argument at all against a real Friedman-like voucher system in which each child would get the same amount whether they attend a public school or a private school, because that would change the menu of schools. The current menu is no indication whatsoever of what a real competitive system would look like, and we shouldn't use the existing menu either to define what we think the choices are or how many will be able to exercise choice for any period of time. Sure, it'll be a few years until the private sector significantly expands, and in the first few years, the private schools are going to exercise some additional discretion when they pick and choose among the flood of applicants that they'll suddenly get. And there'll be a lot of finger-pointing that says, look, we showed you, we said these private schools were going to discriminate and cream and do all that stuff, and some of them will at first. But given the profit incentive, there'll either be a lot of privatization of existing buildings or sharing of buildings or new buildings, and it won't take very long, as $5,000 or $6,000 per student times any size classroom is an awful lot more than they pay a teacher. There's an awful lot of profit potential out there on the given spending, and plus there'll be private spending if we allow, as we need to, schools to charge whatever they want above the voucher amount if they want. Then there'll be private money in the system in addition to the public money that's already there. So current public and private school differences are not that important. They suggest a few things that we can look for, but not very many. We need to transform the system. We don't need a program to move children within the existing system. We need a change in the system. We need to overhaul the menu, not move you from one menu item to the other one. Therein lies the big problem with the school choice debate. It's all thought of in terms of moving from one item on the menu to another one rather than changing the menu, which is what we really need to do. There's some thinking out there that vouchers, at least the universal vouchers where everybody can get them, will only help the rich. Quite the contrary. Even if we have the minimal vouchers that currently are targeted at poor people are only a couple thousand dollars. Even if we have that, we can see from the privately funded voucher programs that that poor people stand in line, as little money as they have, they stand in line to get these little vouchers that they have to supplement. Most of the privately funded vouchers, you have to come up with a couple thousand dollars of your own. You have to be poor, too, to qualify. And so even if we have the wrong kind of voucher program, namely much less than what the public schools are funded at, even that would benefit the poor more than the rich. The rich have halfway decent choices, especially the super rich. It's the poor kids that have the abysmal, terrible choices, and poor families have already shown a huge willingness to sacrifice, to dig deep to find a few extra dollars, to move within the existing system, which if you read some of the Peterson Green stuff, is not all that exciting. But I don't mean the work is all exciting, I mean moving within the existing system. If you look at some of the schools in Milwaukee that the kids moved to, especially early in the 90s when the program started, you would not get goosebumps to read about the shape that these private schools were in. Yet the plain fact of the matter is that the parents were aware of that, and they were desperate to get out of their $6,000, $7,000, $8,000, $9,000 a year per student public school and into these pretty frightening sounding from the description in Peterson and Green private schools. We don't want to hold, as school choice advocates, I don't think we want to hold that out as the alternative to what we now have. We can do a lot better, and we will do a lot better if only we have a level playing field where all the kids get the same amount of money. Another fallacy, every school should accept any child. It goes back to my original point about specialization. You can't have specialization, you can't have schools doing different things if you have a mantra that every school has to accept every applicant. Schools have to have the right to say, no, you're not gifted and talented, sorry. Mom and Dad won't want to hear that. Some of them are living delusions of grandeur that Johnny and Susie has never shown any brilliance before, but by golly, my kid's got to be gifted and talented, and they're going to go to a gifted and talented school. This may not be right. The school may have to say, look, you're going to slow everybody else down. We can't let you in. See, that's seen as discrimination quite often. It's not discrimination. It's saying we have a large body of customers we intend to serve well, and we're not going to let one other customer get in the way of serving all these other well. What we need is a system, specialized system, in which there's some outstanding choices for each child. Not that every choice is halfway decent for every child, which is what we have, almost have now. If you had specialized schools, you couldn't have attendance areas. Right? If a school was specialized in something, you couldn't assign kids to it. Parents wouldn't tolerate that. So we have it's called comprehensively uniform schools, in which they claim to be able to do everything badly. They don't say badly, but that's what happens. I use restaurant analogies all the time. I don't know why that is. I eat a lot. Thank goodness it doesn't show too much. But have you ever been to a restaurant, a good restaurant, that had about 10 different specialties that was really good? Now, there may be some out there, but the vast majority of restaurants that I know of that are good have one specialty. Right? The mega restaurants, which I can't even think of any of, that have like Japanese, Chinese, Greek, Mexican, Italian, all those, all on the same menu, how good are they? Not very good. Well, that's what we have now, is gigantic schools that try to handle the fact that kids are different by having tons of different offerings to send kids off in a different direction. When in fact what we need is smaller schools where kids get to pick, or their parents get to pick and choose which one their kids go to, and each one of them specializes in something, which means that some schools will be shunned by some, but adored by others. Another little aside, I was reading, my mind is bouncing around a little bit too, I get a little wired on this subject. I was reading a few months ago a badly titled but well-written book by Helen Ladd and Ted Fisk, When Schools Compete, A Cautionary Tale. And it's about New Zealand, and what they have in New Zealand is public school choice, universal charter schools, if you will. And they made this mistake that I was alluding to earlier in my presentation about saying, well, you can choose, so there must be competition there. There's no prices, there's no profits, and the government owns all the schools. Yet they claim that there's competition going on there, and they claim that since everybody wants to be in the best schools, since they're all the same and run by the government, it's the same problem. They're comprehensively uniform. They're not specialized to any great extent. You can't, because of politics. There's some things you can't do when the government owns the school, because you can't spend my money. Don't do that, even if you don't have to send your kids there. Well, that's thought of now by some people as what competition would do here, right? Is that everybody would stampede to the good schools and abandon the bad ones. You wouldn't have that if you had a specialized system, right? Because you'd have a stampeding going both directions. Say the school you'd been going to specialized in something that you couldn't stand. Well, you'd leave, right? But maybe they're going to specialize in something that somebody likes, so people that were somewhere else are going to go there. So instead of having this one-way stampede from the not-so-good to the better, like they have in New Zealand, which they predicted would happen anywhere where there's competition, and again, this limited rivalry was all that's going on there. Instead, you have cross traffic. Yeah? The same school that some people are abandoning because they don't like what they're doing there now because they're specialized in something that doesn't work for their kid, other people are flocking there. That's what we need. We don't need a school system in which every school is okay for every kid. We need a school system that has a great school for every kid, or maybe a couple, which means most of the schools are not going to be okay for your kid. Fine, leave. And again, we can locate near the best one. If you have a large family, you might have some transportation problems. Right? But remember, schools will be smaller, too. So you may be near several. Currently, schools, again, much too big. If you're located near one, you're probably far from any others. So we don't want to have a system where we think that schools discriminate if they don't accept every child, because if you force that on them, then they can't specialize. Another problem. It's widely written that the Supreme Court or state Supreme Courts will decide whether vouchers are constitutional. Well, that comes from this static world fallacy that I was talking about earlier, and the thought is, well, gosh, all the private sector is religious now, or almost all of it. So, boy, if we don't let vouchers be used at religious schools, well, then why have them, right? So the First Amendment says, the Supreme Court says the First Amendment says we can't have vouchers for sectarian schools. Well, then why have vouchers? Well, that's a huge fallacy, because I think it would be a mistake for them to rule that. I'm not a legal scholar by any stretch, but it would be a mistake in the sense of freedom and people's ability to choose. And just because if you pay taxes and you like a sectarian school, you shouldn't be discriminated against, right? You should have your voucher or tax credit or whatever like anyone else. But in case they do that, we don't want to give up all hope. Just because the non-sectarian, the secular part of the private school is microscopic now, doesn't mean it can't grow. And if you had a competitive education industry and funded all children the same out of the common pool, our school taxes, the secular part of the private school sector would explode in size. So again, I'm not advocating that we give up on church-run schools having vouchers be able to have vouchers used there. But in case, I don't know what the Supreme Court is going to do. And many states have a Blaine Amendment, which I've been told by several people, we can't have vouchers in our state. We have a Blaine Amendment, which was, I can't remember, the James Blaine back in the 1800s. He tried to get that into the U.S. Constitution, a bar on secular sectarian schools getting any government money, even indirectly. He failed, but he did succeed at the state level in several places. So a Blaine Amendment, if you know what that is or you understand the description, is not a reason a state can't have a competitive education industry through vouchers or tax credits or direct payment or any other method. It's just a reason, until the amendment is repealed, if it can be, to not be able to have the sectarian schools in there. But you can still have a competitive education industry. You just will have to discriminate against the parents that feel strongly that their children should have a religious education. Another issue, contracting out is real privatization. Far from it. Again, contracting out a school to be managed by a private company, there's still no control over prices. There's still not really any free entry. It's still regulated. And you're beholden to the public school authorities, and they can yank your contract at any time, and some have. So you still have to be politically sensitive. Contracting out is not anywhere near real privatization. What Richard suggests, I think, is, not only near, that's the real McCoy, and we need something like that. And last, but definitely not least, a fallacy, school choice is a gamble. Now, usually when you gamble, you have something at risk. Now, please tell me what it is you would miss out of the current system if we were to have freedom to take your share of the education dollars wherever you want. Again, I'm not advocating that the government cease running schools. Personally, I feel that that would be wonderful if that happened. But I'm not advocating it. All I believe is that parents should have the right to take their kid to whichever school. If they like the one that the government runs, that's fine. They can take their share there. And if the school manages to attract enough dollars to stay in business, that's super. So this idea that we need to be cautious, go slow, and these so-called experiments, which are no such thing, that where a few kids get vouchers and then we compare their test scores to somebody else, that supposedly tell us whether the vouchers work. We don't need to be cautious. Competition, tried and true, has worked not only throughout our economy all the time, but has worked throughout history. Richard cited two examples. Our country through about 1840 in England, about the same period, and other periods of history. Read Market Education by Andrew Colson, wonderful book, that describes many other episodes where there was no government at all, and the kids got better educated than they do now with all our school taxes and government schools. You say, how did the poor kids get to charity? Again, I know that's one of the reasons that I'm not going to go out and campaign for that. People, we're going to put them at the mercy of charity. Well, I'm not going to go campaign for that right now, but the fact of the matter is it's worked better than our current system. Charity-run schools has worked better. Kids had a higher degree of literacy than they have now. So school choice is not a gamble. Continuation of the status quo is truly frightening. So the certainties associated with that are much worse than any uncertainties, things that you might, that someone might think could happen if we introduce competition. So there's a minimum step we need, and that's competition. Beyond there, we can quibble over it, but we need to have those minimum conditions, and nothing less will do. And we need it done in a hurry for reasons that we see all around us all the time. It may be too late to win this debate. I hope not, but you've got to win a vote, which means you've got to be able to make the argument in a couple seconds on a billboard or a radio commercial, and I'm not sure that's possible. I hate to end on a pessimistic note. I hope it's still possible, and I'm going to do everything I can in my power to make it possible.
Check.